This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president had two messages he wanted to get out today. First, that the Haitian people will not be forgotten. Second, that he has not forgotten about Wall Street banks either. More American aid is on the way for earthquake relief, as is a tax bill for those banks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Thursday. It is the 14th of January today. The law that established the TARP back a year and a half ago actually requires that the president come up with a plan to make sure the government gets all of its money back. The White House has settled on the catchy title, Financial Crisis Responsibility Fee, for its plan. The money would be used to cover the government's losses from the TARP, something like $117 billion as the accounting stands now. The way it's structured, it would hit only the biggest banks and, in theory, make them less prone to take risks. Whether it's going to work or not, here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
Here's how the White House would like things to play out. It slaps a tax on about 50 of the country's biggest financial institutions for about 10 years. The tax is aimed at money the banks borrow. The idea is that banks would be less inclined to borrow for risky investments. Would it work?
It will reduce risk. It just isn't going to reduce it that much because it's not that big a tax.
That's Douglas Elliott, a former investment banker, now at the Brookings Institution. Elliott says banks earn about $200 billion pre-tax each year. The tax announced today would only collect about $9 billion a year. Elliott says a higher tax would get the bank's attention. How much higher?
Five times higher or something. I mean, it would have to be. It's difficult to know, but it would have to be a lot higher than this.
And the tax does nothing about the fact that some banks are still too big to fail. So if they started teetering, the government would have to bail them out.
These are the institutions that the Fed and the Treasury are telling us that if a single one of them fails, it will produce a global crisis.
Bill Black teaches economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He says the government could make banks break themselves up by taxing them on their size.
I'd give them an incentive through a real tax on their asset size, and they would get rid of the things that made the most sense to get rid of.
But the White House will start with the tax announced today. It still has to be approved by Congress. Legislation to better regulate big banks is already stalled on Capitol Hill. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The year-end real estate numbers for 2009 are in, and they broke all kinds of records, not necessarily good ones. The California-based data firm RealtyTrack says 2.8 million properties fell into some kind of foreclosure action last year. But if you're thinking right about now, whew, at least 2009 is behind us, yeah, don't think that way. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
RealtyTrack's Rick Sharga has his eyes on the relatively new plight of three states in particular because they help explain why the foreclosure mess is getting worse in spite of all the programs to fix it.
We have three that are in the top 10 that didn't appear there or anywhere near there a year ago in Idaho, Utah, and Illinois. And those are really the states that are on the first wave of problems driven by unemployment rates as opposed to bad loans.
In other words, the newer foreclosures have less to do with adjusting payments to make the homes affordable and more to do with the ever-rising unemployment rate, which passed 10% at the end of the year.
I'm an attorney, I'm bilingual, and I have 10 years of experience. It's the sort of thing where you think you've prepared yourself to have a little bit of security.
Bridget Miles hasn't been able to make her house payment since last February after she lost her job in the Maryland suburbs of Washington. She just recently found work again, but has had to admit to herself she doesn't make enough now to pay her mortgage.
I've done a few calculations, and I don't believe I would be able to afford it even if they modified it. So I'm just saving up my pennies to rent.
All over America, homeowners are finding loan modifications aren't always enough. But at the big housing counseling group NeighborWorks, Marietta Rodriguez says homeowners shouldn't give up hope, even if they are out of work.
Does it make a financial institution more apt to modify that loan if they see income? Absolutely. But I've also seen many instances where the financial institution was willing to forbear on that loan while the person got reemployed.
Rodriguez says that still means a race to find work before unemployment benefits run out, which is why she says extending those benefits has become a critical part of keeping people in their homes. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The Golden Globe Awards are this weekend, which means the ever-expanding awards season is upon us. You may be invited to an award-watching party or two, which is great because they're always fun. But for the television networks, the shows are big business. Marketplace's Rico Galliano explains how the ceremonies are changing to bring back viewers.
Ever wonder why there are so many award shows? Here's a hint. It's not because America just loves to celebrate the arts. Martha Littleton of Trade Paper Variety says it's all about TV networks' bottom line.
Networks love award shows because they're relatively inexpensive to produce, and if they draw big audiences, that's a great formula.
Because big audiences mean big ad dollars. But viewership has been shrinking. Last year's Oscars drew the third smallest audience since Nielsen started keeping tabs in 1974. So this year, big changes are afoot in award land. This Sunday's Golden Globes will feature the show's first celebrity host in 15 years, British comedian Ricky Gervais. And the Oscars is expanding its Best Picture category from 5 nominees to 10. Littleton says one reason is to get bigger, more popular films nominated.
Because the Oscar telecast rises and falls on who is in contention for Best Picture. And if people care about who's in the race for Best Picture, the ratings are going to go up. It's just a truism that has held true every year.
Still, some wonder if changes like this can reverse the audience trend. Entertainment industry analyst Hal Vogel says the problem isn't necessarily the shows, it's that there's just too many of them.
You have Oscars, Tonys, Blockbuster Video Awards, Country Music Awards, and so on, Golden Globes. And after a while, they center on pretty much the same personalities and similar formats or categories.
As Meryl Streep admitted to USA Today last November, when actors reach the end of award season and accept their Oscar, quote, "the best acting they do all year is when they act surprised." In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
A quick note now about yesterday's broadcast. We got our math wrong in our commentary on the auto industry and how it's making more cars than anybody could possibly buy. Globally, car makers have 50% more production capacity than they need, not 30%, as we said. Traders took up all the extra capacity on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you want to give money for earthquake relief in Haiti, all you really have to do nowadays is pull out your cell phone. Text message donations to relief groups are already in the millions of dollars. It is perhaps the easiest natural disaster to donate to ever. Instant contribution and instant reward for you, the giver. We've called Katya Andreessen at the nonprofit Network for Good to talk about technology and charity. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
The ability to give mobily has been around for a while, but it has really exploded recently, hasn't it?
From what we've heard from the American Red Cross yesterday, they raised a couple million dollars. We've seen nothing on that scale previously. And I think what you see it going on here is that when people are given an opportunity to act right away, when they feel an impulse to give, they really respond. And that's what technology has brought to giving and fundraising, the opportunity to give when we're seized with the urge to do so, which significantly boosts giving overall.
Does the ease of that technology, though, affect who winds up getting the money? You mentioned the American Red Cross, and everybody knows about them, and they're out there. So do they benefit at the expense of some smaller, less known charities, do you think?
That's a very good question. And what's actually surprising about the answer is, yes, the American Red Cross has done very well with mobile fundraising. But just because an organization is very large doesn't mean it's necessarily highly savvy technologically. And some of the most exciting things we've seen on social networks, on Twitter, on mobile with mobile giving in the recent past, the last year or two, have been campaigns mounted by very small organizations who are seizing upon this technology to level the digital playing field and increase donations to their cause.
Not to give him an undue shout out, but Wyclef Jean, the Haitian singer yesterday, was right out there with his tech service, right?
Absolutely. And then you see groups like Ushahidi, which is a Kenyan-based organization, which is doing mobile crowdsourcing in Haiti. And you see them all over the internet right now, which is just an extraordinary example of a small organization having a big impact.
Do you know off the top of your head how much of these donations, like what percentage of a donation might be lost to what you could fairly call overhead, whether it's to the phone company or the text provider or whatever?
In general, giving with credit cards and giving with mobile, the mobile carriers have been much better about their fees of late, is a pretty efficient way to support a charity. It's a much less expensive way for a charity to receive funds than, say, having to process checks.
Mm. You mentioned that charity or donations in the mobile way have become very much of an impulse buy, right? But once this Haiti story fades from the headlines, that impulse is going to go away, isn't it?
As long as a story is in the headlines, on the front page, on the top of a website, we see giving is very high and steady. But when the story drops out of the news, the urge to give also recedes. And we find that this usually falls and peaks within 6 days of a crisis, even those as large as Katrina or the tsunami. So we certainly urge people to remember that. And when you do feel the impulse to give over the next few days, consider making a recurring gift to your charity. In other words, set up monthly giving so that you'll automatically have your credit card hit each month and you'll be providing the steady support that charities working in Haiti are definitely going to need in the year ahead.
Katja Andreessen is the Chief Operating Officer at Network for Good. They help people and nonprofits find each other online. Katja, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
There is talk this afternoon of a deal on health care, not on the whole thing, mind you, but rather agreement between the White House, Congress, and labor unions over those Cadillac health plans and how much they ought to be taxed. Details still forthcoming, I should tell you. Largely lost in the health care debate, though, is the idea of controlling costs in the way medicine is practiced. There is a school of thought out there that says what you ought to do is take the results of medical studies and run a statistical analysis to figure out what works best for the largest number of people. That is called evidence-based medicine. Commentator and physician Calvin Brown says it only goes so far.
It almost sounds easy. Build a healthcare system around medical practices that are shown most effective for most people. Take arthritis, for example. One pill, let's call it the red pill, has been found to alleviate pain for the vast majority of sufferers. Enough said, next patient. But wait, for the minority, and let's put you in that category, the red pill has little to no effect. For you, the blue pill shows better results, but it costs twice as much. Should you have to take the cheaper pill, even though it doesn't work as well for you? It's tempting to frame the healthcare debate in black and white. Do we choose a system that makes us healthier as a whole and saves us money, but may not give each of us the best individual results? Or do we protect the freedom of choice that's given us the most comprehensive, but also the most expensive healthcare system in the world? Why not try a mix of both? We could start by giving everyone the low-cost red pill. When some people get no relief, we switch them over to the blue pill. We could use some of the savings from having most people take the red one. But this approach does have limits. It may not apply so easily to disease screenings as it does to treatments. Take breast cancer. If we adopt recommendations that women under 50 avoid this screening, we'll save millions of dollars. But some people, 0.001%, will go undiagnosed and die. Is that fair? I don't think so. Any woman who wants a screening should have it. Healthcare doesn't have to be an either-or proposition. We can have cost-effective care that is personalized and high quality. We just need to be smart about how to apply it.
Dr. Calvin Brown teaches rheumatology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Take a minute. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, whether General Motors raised the bar maybe a little too high.
There's nothing wrong with stretch goals. People internally know what they are. It's like telling your kid, hey, I'd like you to see if you can get A's in all of your classes. You know, what's wrong with that?
I don't know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials moved up 0.25% today. 29 points ended at 10,710. The NASDAQ added 0.3%. That is 8 points, closed at 2316. The S&P 500 advanced 0.2%. 2 points, ended the day at 1148. Tech stocks get the credit for the climb. Intel was up all day in anticipation of its earnings announcement after the bell. The giant chipmaker blew past expectations. Its shares surged more than 4.5% in after-hours trading. Oracle shares closed nearly 2.5% higher. Microsoft computed a 2% gain today. That new bank tax we told you about had financial firms coming and to go, and J.P. Morgan Chase was ahead by about 1%. Bank of America deposited 1.2%, but Goldman Sachs gave back 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by MassMutual, a company that provides insurance solutions for women who have faced breast cancer. Information at MassMutual.com/women. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index, letting us know what urban consumers paid for goods and services in December. Can we prevent the next war? That is the topic of a forum at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And civil rights activist and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Martin Luther King Jr. was born on January 15, 1929. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Banking regulators and other government officials took their turns in the hot seat today in front of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation chairwoman Sheila Bair said that she and her colleagues at other agencies, they just flat blew it. Booming bank profits and a rising economy, she said, made it tough to get tough. Securities and Exchange Commission Chief Mary Shapiro said the SEC wasn't successful in keeping an eye on the big Wall Street banks. But the SEC is going to roll out a well-tested tactic in the fight against corporate crime. From Washington, Brett Neely reports.
The SEC is looking for a few good informers. At a press conference yesterday, SEC enforcement head Robert Kuzami said the agency would begin offering immunity in some cases.
When you engage in misconduct, you now have to think even harder about the possibility of others coming forward to report to the SEC your secret conversations, your hushed plans, and your schemes and your deceptions.
Duke law professor James Cox thinks the government will have an easier time convincing potential witnesses to cooperate now.
Because it's always been sort of a question mark. You know, if I turn my guy in, what am I going to get?
Corporate insiders who sing will get charges dropped or reduced in exchange for their testimony and help out the SEC.
They're understaffed here. They really do need to have somebody inside the bastion of violations to cooperate and help them with the investigation.
He says the Bush administration wasn't interested in tough regulation. That meant spectacular scams like the Madoff Ponzi scheme were missed, says Ellen Podgore at Stetson University's College of Law.
Just reading the Madoff report, it's very clear that
it was a system that was not functioning properly.
The Obama administration is beefing up the SEC, but an infusion of money and lawyers still won't work without informers, say experts, particularly as financial markets and financial scams get more complicated. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
The troubles we're having out here in California with our state budget are well documented. The Golden State is proving not quite so golden. It is financially worse off than any other state in the union, and getting worse. This week, Standard & Poor's, the ratings agency, knocked California's rating down a peg to A-. That is still what they call an investment-grade rating. In other words, not so bad. But it is going to make it more expensive for California to borrow its way out of its current mess. But here's the point. After the multi-billion dollar hole that California has dug for itself, the worst that happens is that it gets bumped down to an A-. Maybe that's why the ratings agencies themselves get failing grades. Here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson in New York.
Many investors can't buy debt unless it's been rated by one of the big three agencies, S&P, Moody's, and Fitch. Gary Pollack's managing director at Deutsche Bank Private Wealth Management. He takes ratings into account, but says he'd never buy debt based solely on what the agencies say.
It's nice to know what they think, but I think investors should make their own decision with respect to any investment that they make and not rely solely on a rating.
Investors learned that the hard way a couple years ago when those complex AAA-rated mortgage-backed securities turned out to be junk. But it looks like that hasn't affected investors' faith in the agencies when it comes to the majority of debt.
They still do have credibility, especially on the plain vanilla debt.
Lawrence White is a professor of economics at NYU's Stern School of Business.
The straight corporate debt, the municipal bonds, the state bonds of these kinds.
The stuff that's easier to understand, in other words. But critics have long argued the system is broken. They point out that the rating agencies are paid by the very people who are selling the debt that's being rated. White pushes back. He says, for the most part, that model has held up for decades.
About the biggest criticism you can levy on the rating agencies with respect to their ratings of these more standard securities is that they are usually slow to do the downgrade.
That's a charge echoed by bond investors today who say you'd have to be living in La La Land not to know California's rating deserved to be cut. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
If you work in a place that's got a halfway decent performance review system, you know all about companies setting goals. Just as in personal life, they can be a good thing for businesses to have. Goals can keep people focused, give them a target to shoot for. But if you don't use those goals right, things can go pretty far wrong, as Marketplace's Sean Cole explains.
Things are different now. That's what General Motors keeps saying. It said so at the Detroit Auto Show this week and on a surprisingly interesting conference call with the media last month. GM is literally a different company since emerging from bankruptcy protection.
And what's different here is that in the old GM, we had a tendency to buy our market share.
This is Susan Dougherty, the new VP of sales for North America. By buying market share, she means offering lots and lots of incentives, 0% financing and the like.
I'm certainly not proud of the fact that we've been the incentive leader. There's lots of things I'd like to be a leader in, and it certainly isn't in incentives.
The reason this is interesting is that about 10 years ago, GM had a goal, and it used all of those incentives to try to reach it. The goal was attaining 29% market share, which it hadn't reached for a couple of years at that point. According to legend, GM was so focused on this goal that its employees wore these pins.
It was just a small gold lapel pin with the number 29 on it.
This is Tom Wilkinson, a spokesman for GM. The company never did attain 29%, though it came close in 2002 with 28.3% market share, which is what I don't get. GM seemed to be fetishizing this particular number.
No, I think some people in the press were fetishizing it. I wouldn't take the pins too seriously. It was a stretch goal.
That is, a goal beyond your usual abilities.
There's nothing wrong with stretch goals. People internally know what they are. It's like telling your kid, hey, I'd like you to see if you can get A's in all of your classes. You know, what's wrong with that?
I'll tell you what's wrong with it, says Lisa Ordonez, a management professor at the University of Arizona.
I've actually seen that particular instance of
children and students who have these stretch goals of all A's, and especially if you incentivize them, like paying for all A's, can lead to unethical behavior like cheating on an exam or having someone write a paper for you.
Ordonez is one of four academics who released a paper last year called Goals Gone Wild. She's not suggesting that GM cheated or did anything unethical, but she says the example of the company lowering prices, etc., to sell a certain number of cars, it just shows how goals can get you into trouble.
And this led to, for them, a focus away from profitability and to achieve this goal myopically. Now, I'm not going to say that that goal was the entire downfall of GM, but obviously strict adherence to goals can cause these kind of problems.
Problems like ignoring other more important goals, such as customer service or product quality. Also, different employees are motivated differently. Goals don't always work. And, yes, there's the cheating. Ordonez told me about a company called Miniscribe, which I had never heard of.
Well, there's probably a very good reason why you haven't heard of Miniscribe. They are now a defunct company that had set sales target goals.
It was a hard drive manufacturer. Turns out the sales were real, but the products weren't.
At the time, this was a while back when hard drives were about the size and weight of a brick. And so they mailed boxes full of bricks to mimic actual sales so that they could achieve specific goals based on revenues.
Now, this is a very extreme example, and detractors of this research say it's just a bunch of extreme examples supporting a dubious premise. But Ordonez and her colleagues aren't saying don't use goals. They're just saying be wary of how you use them and which goals you set. And while Tom Wilkinson at GM rejects the professor's opinion of the company's actions back in the day,
it's a gross oversimplification of the complexities that GM was facing 10 years ago.
The new president for North America, Mark Royce, used the 29 pins as an example of what GM is not doing now.
We're not printing pins. We're not doing that stuff. So,
and if you ask both of these guys what GM's goals are at the moment, they say the same thing.
To make, build, and sell better vehicles than anybody else.
Design, build, and sell the world's best vehicles.
And if they can do that, the market share will take care of itself. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, who does what at 11:35 at night on NBC has kind of faded from the headlines, whether it's Jay Leno or Conan O'Brien in The Tonight Show. But the folks at FunnyOrDie.com have done what they do best. They tapped into O'Brien's voicemails and found this from NBC CEO Jeff Zucker.
Great news, buddy. Tonight Show at 11:35 is happening. You are on every night at 11:35 until 11:37. Then Jay is 11:37 to 11:39.
See, nothing to it. I thought that one was pretty clever, actually. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 29 points, a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ up 8 points, a third percent. The S&P 500 hiked up 2 points, 0.2%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Get the latest in business and economic news tomorrow, bright and early, on the Marketplace Morning Report. And coming up next time on this broadcast, for the folks at North Face, the clothing company, brand identity is everything.
This is about consumer choice. This is about a consuming public that's smart enough to know the difference between a face and a butt and not believe that somehow when they pick up a butt, they bought a face.
You're going to have to listen tomorrow to figure out what that means. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thanks a lot for being with us.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.